Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan, and you're listening at CindySheehanSoapbox.com. Our Soapbox guest today is Martina Correa, sister of recently executed Troy Anthony Davis. It's a very timely and meaningful show, and I know there's a lot of things going on around the country with the Occupy Wall Street movement and, you know, Occupy Everywhere movement, and that's very important, and here at the Soapbox, and personally, we're in solidarity with that, but I don't think that we should forget the sacrifice and martyrdom of Troy Davis and work really hard against the institutional inequalities that keep allowing executions in this country, the death penalty and the inequality of so-called cop killers being murdered by the state when killer cops get to basically go free with a slap on the wrist. Martina Correa, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first of all, I just want to extend my profound condolences and condolences of many of the Soapbox listeners who told me to pass on their love and support for your family.
Thank you.
There's one issue that I am very, very interested in myself from my own son's death in Iraq, and that's accountability. I read where you are working on holding the people accountable for Troy, your brother Troy's death. And what I want to know is who are the ones that were wrong and how can we hold these people accountable?
Well, one of the things is the parole board. The parole board is not a judicial body. And so, you know, we go, the defense side, we go in there with court documents, proof, witnesses, things like that. And the other side, the victim side, they come in later after us, and they're able to say whatever they want to say, even though the judge has said you can't say this in court because it's not true. They'll, you know, they'll start talking about different things. Like last time they were talking about bloody shorts, and they were like, there's no such thing as bloody shorts. There was no DNA or anything else linking Troy to the crime. And then this year they decided to start talking about there has to be shell casings that match. They found shell casings all over the city. And they were like, well, homeless people turn in their shell casings, and that's how they link one shooting to the next shooting. Mm-hmm. And but there still was not anything with Troy's fingerprints on there. But yet still they came out and told the press that they linked Troy to the shooting because of shell casings and that they linked him to more than one shooting. So, you know, those things are not factual. And the parole board is made up of former prosecutors, former police officers, and things like that. And then when they vote how they want to vote, and they vote in secrecy. They don't have to have any kind of legal entities talking to them or anything like that. They just listen to the information, and they make a decision based on their personal issues or personal feelings.
Well, and you have, you know, you've identified the parole board and their relationship to the police state apparatus, and, you know, it's inherently weighted against somebody who is, you know, unjustly part of their system and somebody who has, you know, literally his life is in their hands. But talk about the institutional inequalities of the system that actually railroaded your brother to death, and your brother was obviously, to people who can actually read and think, an innocent man.
Yes, I mean, I believe that too. I believe that, you know, just like the gentleman in Georgia that just got a stay until February. The parole board was so nasty, and they were about to deny him. This man would have been dead on Tuesday if a court had not have stepped in and defended him. You know, and that's how the parole board is. The parole board in Georgia, if you say, I'm guilty, but I'm sorry, then they'll spare your life. If you want to fight the system and say, I'm not guilty, you know, I didn't do this, then, you know, they don't care about that. They don't think you're remorseful, and therefore they will make sure that you're executed. You know, they wanted Troy to plead guilty for life without parole with not the possibility of any appeal. But Troy said he couldn't plead guilty for something he did not do, you know, because the first thing people will say is, see, we told you he did it. And, you know, he said that it was not worth, you know, lying and saying that you killed somebody that you didn't. So, you know, it takes a lot out of a person to admit that you're more willing to die than to admit that you did something wrong when you didn't do it. So, you know, I have the utmost respect for Troy because Troy said, you know, if they are successful in killing me, he said, then don't allow my death to be in vain. Mm-hmm. He said this barbaric practice of the death penalty and state-sanctioned killing of the innocents need to stop. And this Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996 needs to be abolished, you know, because of the fact that not only was it instated in 1996, but President Bill Clinton made it retroactive 10 years, which is against international human rights law.
Right.
And so Troy's case should not have been affected by it anyway because his case happened in 1989. So they made this law retroactive. So when the witnesses began to come forward and tell the truth, Troy's case never had a chance because they said, well, we don't have to listen to your actual innocence because of the anti-terrorism bill, you know. And so it's like you don't have a chance from the beginning. And they tried to keep Troy voiceless by denying him access to the press, denying him access to any media outlet, any radio, any shows like that. And, you know, they would threaten him with, we'll take your family visitation away from you if you're caught talking to the press or the media.
Well, and Troy can't express remorse or couldn't express remorse for something he didn't do, but I heard him express his sorrow to the family who lost their loved one, and he actually said that, I hope you don't let this end and you actually get the real person who killed Officer McPhail because it wasn't me.
Exactly.
And wasn't one of the, if I'm correct, wasn't one of the witnesses that didn't recant his accusations actually implicated in the murder himself?
Could you repeat that question?
Yes, one of the witnesses who did not recant his testimony against your brother was actually implicated, one of the people implicated in the murder.
Mm-hmm.
So
well,
he had everything to gain.
There was another witness, Sylvester Coles, who did not recant, and he was the only one that actually had a weapon on the scene. And he did not even tell police that he had a weapon on the scene. And when they asked him, you know, why didn't you tell us you had a weapon, he said, because I'm a convicted felon, I'm not supposed to have a weapon. And they asked him, what do you use your weapon for? And he says, for protection. And my thing is, from protection from whom? So, you know, he drinks until he's drunk. And then I don't know what else he does, but I know that he was the one that pointed the finger at Troy.
Mm-hmm.
And up until then, they had no knowledge of anyone who had shot the police officer. And when he went into the police station, they didn't know what was going on. And then when he did come in there, other witnesses, including Larry Young, who was pistol whipped, saying, that's the guy right there that attacked me. And then the police officer says, oh, no, 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 you have the wrong guy. He's helping us with the investigation.
Mm.
So, you know.
Wow.
It is what it is. But, I mean, how do you have, you know, more than one person in a parking lot where a police officer gets killed and you don't charge both people with accessory? You know, you don't charge the other person with accessory when, you know, they even lied about having a weapon. And then when they asked, where's your weapon? Oh, I gave it to so-and-so. Well, so-and-so said, you didn't give it to me. Oh, I hid it in the bushes. Oh, I don't know where it is. And next thing you know, they wanted to say, oh, they threw their gun away, but there was never a subpoena to search their home or any of their private things to find the weapon. So they didn't really look very hard to find this weapon.
Right. Well, I mean, I've noticed, and you probably, you know, have more information on this than me, but if a police officer gets killed, just somebody has to pay for it. Somebody has to die. And it doesn't matter, really, if that person is guilty or innocent.
Right.
And that's one of the institutional inequalities that we have. You know, I'm from California, and, you know, we have the Oscar Grant killing, and a young black man was just killed by San Francisco police for not paying his bus fare. And when there's killer cops, they barely get a slap on the wrist.
Right, right, exactly. You know, and that's why we have to get rid of the death penalty, because it's a selective process.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they give the death penalty to people who cannot fight back. I mean, if you look at big serial killers and these big people that get all the media attention and everything at the beginning of their trial, you have lawyers lined up to defend them because it's going to be on television, and it gives the lawyers, you know, an opportunity to be seen, you know. And so then you have people that, you know, don't have lawyers, don't even have the resources to pay for a lawyer, and you'll be the first to offer them, you know, a vehicle out of town or something.
Right. And it's very hard to be a poor person of any color and get justice in our system.
Mm-hmm.
So this question is difficult for me sometimes when people ask me this question. So if you don't feel up to answering it, we all know Troy Anthony Davis as a symbol of anti-death penalty work, and, you know, as somebody who courageously struggled against a system. Is very hard to do that, to struggle against the system. But you became involved in this partially to say that Troy Davis is not just a symbol, he's my brother, he's a person. And so you made it a very personal struggle. If you feel up to it, can you talk a little bit about Troy, your brother?
Well, my brother was the type of person that, you know, we lived in the first upper-middle-class black neighborhood in Savannah. You know, we had the two cars, the boat, the fence, the new house. So, you know, we had both parents growing up. And so, you know, we were children that were very blessed, you know. And Troy was always very shy. Everybody called him a mama's boy. Mm-hmm. Including himself. That's what he called himself, a mama's boy. So most of the time when you find Troy, you'll find Troy at home. he'll cut the grass, wash the dog. I had a sister who they diagnosed when she was 13 with MS, and Troy had left day school and enrolled in night school so that when my sister got out of the hospital, my mom wouldn't have to miss work. Troy would take care of my sister, my little sisters, and my brother. And so that's what he did for a long time. And, you know, he took care of them and did my sister's hair and took my sister to therapy and things like that. A lot of people don't know that. And then they would put in the paper that he dropped out of school when Troy actually graduated with honors. There's pictures of him in the Savannah News Press where he graduated with honors. And we played football. He played us. We didn't have soccer back then, so it was like baseball, football. And then when he got to be a teenager, he helped out with the coaches as an assistant junior coach. And we played ball for the Police Athletic League. We had the Police Athletic League in our neighborhood because the police officer that actually ran it, you know, he wanted to do something with the kids, and so, you know, that's what he did. He got together the kids and started a little league thing in our neighborhood, and we played ball, and, you know, people made it seem like, you know, we hated the police, but we played ball for the Police Athletic League. Mm-hmm. Half of our subdivision was police officers. Actually, the present police chief lived right around the corner. I mean, it was not like, you know, we were a bane on existence. If Troy was, he would probably have been a juvenile and all this other stuff. And so a lot of the things that they put in the paper weren't true. The Savannah News Press, when a black person is accused of doing anything, they put everything but your mother's Social Security number in the newspaper to try to degrade you.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're convicted of whatever it is before you even go to court, you know, because
right.
nobody pays it any attention. They just read what's in the paper, and that's pretty much about it, you know. So it's really weird the way that they do that. But Troy was always a type of person that he believed in, you know, the ideals that my parents taught us, especially my father. You tell the truth, and things will always work out right. Well, he told the truth this time, and it didn't work out right. And so, you know, I gave up my military career so that I could make sure that things were going to work out right for him. And it's become a long struggle, a long fight, and things like that. But, you know, Troy is the type of person that was very shy. And so, you know, we just had to... we had to get an adjustment to agree with some of the stuff that was going on. So, you know, but Troy was the type of person, he didn't care, keep a whole lot of girlfriends and things. If he had a girlfriend, he had one girlfriend, and they would be together for years. He wasn't, you know, one person that goes from girl to girl to girl and all these other things. Troy was just a simple, nice person. If he needed to cook dinner for my brothers and sisters, he cooked dinner for my brothers and sisters. That's what he did.
How did he find himself in that situation to be accused of being a murderer?
Could you repeat that?
How did he find himself in the situation of being accused of being a murderer just at the wrong time?
Well, you know, Troy was the type of person that was always, what we called him was the person that always helped somebody else. He would always kind of stick his nose in where it didn't belong and try to help somebody else. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so behind the garage door or whatever, the door was down, or at least loosened the hinges. And so, you know, when the police came barging in the doors or whatever, that's when, you know, our family kind of found out about what was going on. But Troy had a car that my mom gave him, and the transmission was out. So he would be home for the weekends, and then he was working in Atlanta during the weekdays, you know, on different construction sites making money because he was going into the Marine Corps. I was in the Army. My father was in the Army, and Troy wanted to go into the Marine Corps. So, you know, and that's why I actually had to come with him and just fill out any paperwork for physicals and stuff like that. So he, you know, when he found out about it, he called home and he said, you know, there has to be some kind of mistake. You know, I'll be home. I'll go down there and answer their questions and tell them what's going on. And, you know, then they'll let me go. But they never interrogated Troy. You know, to the day Troy died, he was never interrogated by the Savannah Police Department. All they did was when he turned himself in, they asked him where was his gun. He said he didn't have a gun. And they said, where's your gun? And he repeated, I don't own a gun. And then next thing I know, they had him locked up, and they gave him his arraignment date, and then they crucified him in the Savannah News Press.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've taken this personal tragedy and made it your personal quest. And I've read that because of you and your work, that hundreds of thousands of people have come to the anti-death penalty movement. Can you tell my listeners how they can become involved or more involved in that movement, and especially in your quest for accountability?
Well, you know, I was in the United States Army. I'm a Gulf War veteran of Desert Shield, Desert Storm. But, you know, in order for me to help my brother, I had to give up my military career. I never expected to have to do that. But, you know, I was willing to do that to save my brother's life.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was just really amazing because, you know, I wanted to help my brother, and I specifically asked him, you know, did you do this? Did you have anything else to do with this? And he said, of course not. He said, I didn't have anything to do with this man being killed. And he said, you know, not today, not yesterday, not tomorrow. He said, you know, I wouldn't lie about that because, you know, Troy was a junior deacon in the church, and Troy said, I could not take anybody's life.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, he said, if I had to do it because I was in the military, then that would be my job. But he said, just to randomly shoot somebody, you know, over a can of beer, because he was trying to stop a homeless man from being pistol whipped. I mean, if somebody stole your bicycle in the neighborhood, Troy would go to the person and say, look, I'll give you $10. Just give the young child their bicycle back. I mean, he was a peacemaker.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he wasn't a person that was an agitator or a fighter or whatever. I mean, people had respect for Troy. Even when he went to jail, they had respect for Troy, you know. And they always did until we got this last warden who was so nasty to Troy, and we couldn't figure out why he was always so nasty to Troy. And Troy has been there over 20 years and has not gotten any trouble, and all of a sudden you get this new warden, and then all of a sudden he's just the meanest person on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
Something is wrong with that picture, and let you know that, you know, the warden and were trying to agitate him, but he wouldn't allow that. Troy was a very prayerful and very faithful person, and he believed strongly in his faith, and he believed that that was going to carry him through, you know. So, you know, Troy did not try to, you know, cause problem with the system. Troy wanted to find out more about his case, and he read every detail and all kind of statements to try to help himself, so that, you know, he would be up on his case and things like that.
How can people still help you in your cause?
Well, they can go to Amnesty's website, www.aiusa.org, and they can put in Troy's name in the search engine. It'll have all the things that we're doing and the things that we will be doing. They could text the word Troy to 90999. They can go on the national NAACP's website, www.naacp.org. They can go on Troy's website, www.troyanthonydavis.org. And any of these things, they can find out ways to help Troy Davis. And Troy also has a Facebook. I think it has all his information on there.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, he can he can tell them what they're doing, and you know, they can go and they can do different things. I mean, they can come up with their own things. We're working on legislation to get rid of the death penalty in Georgia and in the South. We're trying to expose the old laws that they have here, because it seems to me that, you know, ever since President Obama became president, and we've had some other issues here in the city, and then Troy's case has been so, you know, out there in the public, that a lot of the old-time comments, you know, a lot of the racist comments that people thought were dead and gone are just, they've just been hidden. They're just viable. I mean,
mm-hmm.
people are saying all kind of vile things,
mm-hmm.
not just about Troy,
right.
but about other black people. And it's really amazing, because I wonder how some of these people go sit into their places of worship and then they're still spouting racism. And it's kind of like, It never went away. It just subsided.
Right.
And
right.
I never thought that in this day and time I would be having an argument with my child's teacher about the way my child is being treated because a teacher does not like my brother. You know, and I've had to come across that in the last couple of years,
mm-hmm.
and that's very, very sad. So, you know, there's many ways to get involved. And I just tell people to stand up where they are, and even if they develop their own system of getting involved, writing letters to the president, writing letters to Eric Holder, asking them for a judicial investigation into the circuit. But, you know, there's various things that can be done, and we're just asking people just to get involved. If you can't do anything else, just get involved and find out what we're doing. And don't allow Troy's death to be in vain. And, you know, we need to continue to work on this issue.
Well, thank you, Martina, and thank you for your strength and your courage, too. And my last question is, how are you holding up? You were also battling cancer, and I know that this is a very emotional, personally, I know this is a very emotionally draining time for you. How are you doing?
Well, actually, I'm doing fine. I was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer in 2001, and I was given 6 months from there. I'm actually in remission. A lot of people think that, you know, I'm having all these problems with cancer and stuff like that, but I'm in remission, and the problems that I've been having is not necessarily with cancer, but with having side effects to the medication
mm-hmm.
that you take to prevent cancer from coming back. I mean, that's the thing that I've been fighting. So my thing is taking chemo for 10 years, even though it's a small dose, it has its effects on your body and things like that. And but other than that, I mean, I'm in remission. I'm doing well. I just have to battle the symptoms of cancer and cancer-related illnesses. So that's what I'm working on now. So, you know, I tell people, you know, the thing about it is I take poison so that I can live.
Yeah.
They gave my brother poison so that they could kill him. And there should be something wrong with that picture.
Well, I know that there is a lot of hatred and racism in this world still, but I hope you also feel the love and support and are able to draw some strength from that.
Okay. I will.
Okay, Martina Correa, thank you for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Thank you.
That was our guest, Martina Correa. I hope you access the websites that she gave us and learn how to stand up against the death penalty, something that I believe is so barbaric and so unnecessary, and it just is something that the state likes to keep going for its own power and for its, you know, reign of terror, like Martina said, against the citizens. Well, that's the show for this week. I'd like to thank my engineer, Scott Cuddy, my webmaster, Rich Bowser, my producer, Mikey, you for listening, and our very special guest, Martina Correa. And I wish the same thing to you, the listeners, that I wish to Martina, and that's love and strength and courage. We'll talk to you next week. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'm Cindy Sheehan.
Make my witness. I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work. Scared of losing their job. Dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street. There's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe, and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes. As if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to ride. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
Chairs. They're yelling in Baton Rouge.